John Bolton on 15 March 78. Yeah, you said that someone at O&R had always wanted to put a radio dish up on the Palomar?
No. Put, when I said put alongside, I meant...
Figuratively.
Figuratively, I see. Yes.
So you went to Caltech in 55 then and brought Gordon Stanley with you. And what was the situation you found there? That you had a lump of money and had to decide
no,
to spend
it? No, I found I didn't have any money. I found I had a grant of $90,000 for the first year from ONR, and there was no university support going with it. In fact, the university were taking 33% of that as overhead. And I essentially had to think of what I was going to do. I mean, I had talked in letters to Dubridge about the possibility of using an interferometer, a variable spacing interferometer consisting of two quite sizable steerable telescopes, or perhaps a Mills Cross. But at that time, I really hadn't made up my mind. It was only when Gordon and I started looking at the Mills Cross and it, all its problems and so on that we decided the dishes were the thing. And high frequencies. And then I had to write a proposal to try and get money, and we tried approaching, well, we approached the Rockefeller Foundation, actually, for money, and that approach was actually in competition with Taffy Bone, who approached only 210. But and O&R were really staggered when I came up with my first estimate of what the Owens Valley was going to cost, something of the order of $760,000 was my first accounting for this, you see. And, they really did back me very handsomely, as it turned out, the cost was closer to $1 million 4 years later than the three-quarters of a million I'd estimated, but that wasn't too bad.
But in fact, your proposal was for two 90-foot dishes?
It yes.
Didn't have to get scaled down?
No. No, well, 90-foot was the sort of largest size. I mean, I could see, you know, at Dover Heights, I could look at my 80-foot hole in the ground and visualize that on the mounting. But then I looked 220-foot down to the sea, and I couldn't see that on the mounting at that stage. At least not as far as I was concerned building it.
That was a whole new regime.
That was a whole new regime. And,
which, of course, the Parks dish and the Jotto Bank dish has demonstrated. But how long did it take to get this money, first of all? And then tell me about the construction and so forth.
Well, we just continued on a around $100,000 budget a year. We had a small group. Matthews joined us. We built, first of all, we had to do a site survey, find out where the best place, and this maybe took us 6 months. In the meantime, Stanley was keen to get a small dish built, A, to experiment with receivers, and B, with the drive. So in the first year, we started work on the 32-foot dish, which we built at Palomar, which was a model of, I remember building out of bits and pieces of brass wire and so on, what I felt the restricted polar axis design with the intersecting axes was the cheapest of all. It wouldn't give us, it gave us plus or minus 4 hours an hour angle, and that was the restriction on it. And of course, Bruce Rule and C.W. Jones, we started pushing backwards and forwards the ideas on the actual 90-footers. In the meantime, we were doing scaling on the 30-foot. We drove the telescope with servo motors and magnetic amplifiers, and we scaled this.
I see.
And, you know, a lot of the design work for the 90-footers on its drive, and its receiver system was done on the 32-footers. Well, then we picked on the Owens Valley, and...
What were the criteria that you had for a site?
Protection, principally. The Owens Valley appealed to me because the whole valley was owned by the Los Angeles municipality, and no industrial development was going to take place there.
Also because they'd taken out all the water.
They'd taken out all the water and so on. And I remember the meeting we had with the president of the forget what, oh, president of the water resources for Los Angeles County, and Leedy Bridge, and I, and I think Art Laffer from ONR had lunch with him, and we put our case, and it looked very, very difficult. You know, the man just showed no reaction whatsoever, and at the end of it he said, "Do you know I've been to 13 eclipse, solar eclipses?" So we got our site in the Owens Valley and we started to develop it. The ONR funds, of course, would only cover the operation and the personal property. And I think it was one of the directors of Bullocks who was talked into, that's a store in Pasadena, giving us $100,000 for sort of on-site development, the rail tracks and the housing and that kind of thing.
So you didn't get anything directly from Caltech, except your salaries?
Caltech paid half my salary, that was all my contribution to radio astronomy, and charged overhead on the other half, which paid for it. And
Was there any push from the optical astronomers for this time, in particular Bob and Minkowski, or were they on the sidelines entirely?
Rudolf, I got to Caltech, and of course I started this. I was given a room and a desk and a chair, and 9 o'clock on the first Monday morning, Rudolf came into my office and he said, "Well, I don't want to influence you, but..." And I think for the next 4 years, Rudolf appeared at 9 o'clock on Monday morning to find out how he wanted his weekly report on how things were going.
So he was very interested.
He was very interested.
But did he actually have any influence, I mean, for instance, in trying to get you...
No, I mean, he was interested in... he was interested in the identification problem. And what he wanted to make sure of was I was doing the right thing to get what he wanted. And
But what I'm trying to get at, there was apparently no push from the optical astronomers at Caltech for this radio observatory. They didn't fight it, but they weren't really out there fighting with you either.
Oh, yes, I mean, I think Jesse Greenstein has helped greatly, and some of the younger people like Guido Munch and so on. But, I mean, to them it was obviously going to take us quite a number of years to get going, particularly on something as massive as what I was proposing. And so it wasn't really the direct interest until things started to happen.
Now, you say as massive as what you were proposing. The dishes were of somewhat different design. However, an 85-foot dish in that day was large, but not unheard of. All right, there was one going in an NRL, and of course the Dwingelow dish, and so forth.
The Dwingelow dish was the only one.
Well, the 84-foot NRL, well, I guess that was a bit later, wasn't it?
No, it was later.
61 or...
90-footers were the first of that size to be operational.
Is that right? Okay. And of course they were on rail tracks, which was an entirely new aspect also. So in fact, I guess there were a lot of unknowns that you had to look into, which naturally spread out the construction time and so forth. Were there any particular troubles during construction, or did it all go pretty smoothly, if maybe a bit slowly?
No, it all went very well. I mean, we had tremendous assistance from Bruce Rule, and he and I worked very closely together for 4 years. And
what was his position?
He was chief engineer at Caltech. He was officially in charge of the synchrotron, the engineering for the 200-inch, and that kind of thing. And Bruce is quite a surprising person. He really wanted to understand what the scientist was doing. He wasn't the sort of person who would make this for me. He wanted to understand why it was being made and whether it was the best method of tackling the problem. And I worked quite closely with him. I used to go with him on his trips to Palama. I helped scrub the mirror for the first successful coating that was put on the 200-inch. I worked with him on the gearing of the Lick telescope, the Lick 120-inch, when it was in difficulties, and so on. So I learned as much about optical telescopes from him as he learned about radio telescopes from me. And it was one of the associations which I very greatly valued at Caltech. And then, of course, Bruce, when this telescope was getting to its bidding stage, when the design was almost complete, Taffy Bowen had Bruce and I go to London for a month to do a criticism of this.
For the Parkes telescope.
For the Parkes telescope, and Bruce came out here during its construction, and that kind of thing.
And so you're saying that there were no particular cost overruns or lengthy delays?
No, there weren't cost overruns, but I've always been a person who kept reasonably within his costs. And for many years I used to do estimates for people. I remember one occasion I was involved in the setting up of Green Bank and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I was kicked off the committee which approved the 140-foot, and Rule resigned from it. And I remember one occasion, I think it must have been about 58 at Boulder, Dick Emerson said, you know, John, what do you think it's going to cost? What do you think that 140 was going to cost us? I said, well, you won't have any change after $20 million, Dick. He said, I've got a surprise for you. We've got to bid for $4.8 million from... I said, that's, you know,
Your statement still stood, no?
Yeah. My statement still stood.
Yeah. What was the final cost of the 140 foot?
$19.5 million. But that was after the contractors had been changed three times and the design had been changed four times.
When were the first observations taken with a single 90 foot at least, and then two?
The day it was dedicated, I think, which must have been about November 58. Was it 58 or 59?
I can probably check that.
Probably November 58. I mean, we had a working receiver on the single telescope.
Right, and then what about as an interferometer?
Roughly 12 months later. That was the first observations. We didn't really get working until, I took a few months off at that stage when we got the two dishes completed, and I came out here for Christmas and then went to Europe. And it was in passing through ONR that Russell Slonaker talked to me and showed me his...
You mean NRL?
Yes, NRL. Yeah. Showed me his records at Jupiter. You know, he got 400 degrees for the temperature.
Ten centimeters.
Yeah. And I was awfully convinced. And I rang up Gordon Stanley. I think this was in February. Mm-hmm. And told him of Russell's results. And by the time I got back to Caltech, which was only two or three days later, he and Jim Roberts had found Jupiter at 960, and it wasn't 400 degrees, but 6,000 degrees.
That's how Caltech got involved with the Jupiter radiation.
Yes. Yeah. And then, of course, later on, when he got the interferometer, Radhakrishnan and Roberts and I did the showed that it was belt radiation.
Just out of curiosity, when you went to Caltech, when did you think you probably would get something going? Did you think it was going to be 4 or 5 years?
I thought 2 years.
But of course you didn't know what you were going to build either at that stage.
No, I initially had gone for 2 years.
Oh, you mean you thought even you'd come back after 2 years?
Well, I thought I'd get something off the ground in 2 years. Mm-hmm. And I had an initial 2-year appointment. It did spread out to, well, it was very close to four. But then, I mean, I expected to go with the go-ahead and the money to build something, and essentially took 2 years to overcome the inertia, and I remember Jesse Greenstein one day when I was, you know, really infuriated at the delays that were being imposed, getting very fed up about it, and Jesse said to me, "Well, you know, you don't have to worry, John. You're a Caltech. You've arrived." I said, "That's all. I haven't come for that, Jesse. I'm going to build you an observatory. I'd like to get on with it."
So, having these dishes,
you know, things like the negotiations for the land in the Owens Valley was really protracted, the difficulties with the Navy as to whether they could own something which was not, they could have something on land. Owens Valley would not give us land, you see.
The Los Angeles,
Los Angeles Council, water supply wouldn't give us land. So there was all sorts of difficulties. Three things I learnt in Pasadena were union law, contract law, patent law.
They probably don't do you much good in Australia where they're all different.
No, well, I mean, the complications one gets into with federal funds in the state, with a non-profit organization in the state of California where the contractor is based in Arizona and so on.
On municipal land.
So on land which is owned by the Los Angeles Water Supply. And, so, I mean, that's...
Yeah.
Well,
but it seems to me, from all the people I've talked to about these sort of large projects, that it's not maybe always that same set, but there's always a set of problems like that. It always takes about 1.5 to 2 times more.
Yeah, well, I mean, I hope to see the dishes going up in 2 years, in fact. But, of course, when they did go up, they went up very fast because we chose a method of construction in which we'd specified everything. I mean, we designed it down to the last nut and bolt instead of saying, here is an outline to contract. As a matter of fact, the scheme got us into problems that way because we had already spent a lot of money on the detailed design, which many companies would have done themselves, but we still had to put up with the overhead which goes along with doing that. I mean, the company that originally finally built the 90-footers was the, can't even remember the name of it, Phoenix, Arizona. They built highway bridges and guardrails for the Arizona highways. But I mean, they only had one engineer on their staff and two draftsmen. But our job suited them because it was it was ready to go into the machine shop.
Well, let's talk about, before we get into the radio astronomy that came out of Caltech, let's talk about a couple of meetings and trips that you took. For instance, I see here that at the Manchester Symposium, you presented a paper showing some variations in Hydra A, which I guess in hindsight turned out to be probably not correct. Remember this?
That was mainly Bruce Slee's work. We got certain days. I mean, undoubtedly the variations were there. And undoubtedly it's a peculiar atmospheric phenomenon. But exactly why, I don't think it's ever been chased down. And
But you were at Jodrell Bank. You presented the paper.
Yes.
What I'm particularly interested in is your reactions to what went out of this meeting. What do you think were the high points of that meeting? What are your recollections of it?
Zero.
You don't remember at all the 2C results and or.
Yes, and of course that was followed by Dublin.
Yes, right.
Yes, well, you know, my reaction was there's something horribly wrong.
Why?
In fact, we had a special meeting one night at the IAU in Dublin. Well, I mean, it was just impossible to distinguish
because of
the old business, discernibility and detectability.
Right, so you'd already been through all this.
You know, I just couldn't pin it down. And out of that, of course, came a letter to the observatory, which I wrote, which said how it happened.
Let's see.
This must have been the observatory around the end of 1955.
Okay, well, I don't seem to find that one here, but...
Well, maybe we can look it up in the library.
But in any case, and so in this paper you pointed this very fact out, that they were confusion limited, essentially?
Well, the thing that I pointed out is whether you are noise limited or confusion limited, you will always get an answer which is steeper than the real slope. And the reason for this is the following, that if you, say, take an ideal universe, Euclidean universe, with all your objects the same flux density, initial power and everything, right, you'll get a slope of minus 3 over 2. And it intersects the x-axis at some point here, which is based on what the average power is and what the average density is. Now then, if you then take a population of objects which has some dispersion around that absolute power,
right,
you get a line which intersects the axis further along.
Right.
Now, if you make experimental errors, and those errors increase as your flux density decreases, you are going to go from one line to another line to another line.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what raises the slope. I mean, a very crude argument.
Right. This is closely related to the Malmquist effect, I believe, is as the name for it. Namely, when sensitivity cuts this off, that you get a systematic effect at the at the low signal noise points.
But then back at Caltech, Westfold and me. Had Westfold joined me? No, he hadn't at that stage. I did an experiment with two graduate students. I took the 2C antenna and synthesized a strip of the sky.
Yes.
And what we did was we had a sample of sources which would give us a log n log s of slope 3 over 2. We wrote them on bits of paper and threw them into a hat. And then we took another 10,000 bits of paper and wrote source on 300 of them, corresponding to 300 in this box, and put them in another hat, you see. And then the graduate students sat down and pulled pieces of paper out, and they came to a source. We had another hat too, with some relative phases. Come to a source, you picked a flux out, and you picked a relative phase out.
Right.
And then we synthesized what you would see with the 2C interferometer.
Right.
Now, the first experiment, we just took the first 50 sources out. I mean, we had a listing where they'd come in the sky, what flux they were, and what the phase relative to the adjoining source would be, because this is important in interferometry, you see. And then we synthesized the interference pattern, first with the 50 sources. And the other graduate student analyzed this, and he picked out, I think, 30 of the 50 sources pretty reasonably in flux and position. Mm-hmm. And then we did it again by adding it to 100 and presented him with this again, you see.
With 100 sources now.
With 100 yeah. sources. And he picked out 20 with reasonable results, you see. And then we put the other 200 in. And I think he got 2.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, this was just to satisfy yourself that...
Mm-hmm. Didn't publish that result.
That's, no, we didn't publish
that's
it.
That's too bad. That would have been known as the three-hat experiment or something.
Yes.
Were those graduate students, did they later go into radio astronomy? Just out of curiosity.
No, one was George... I think one was George Wallerstein.
Oh, really? I'll be darned.
I couldn't be sure of that. I couldn't be sure that it was George. George did work with us to a certain extent. It might have been George.
Hmm. You said there was a special evening meeting at Dublin. What took place at this meeting?
This was the IAU in 1955 at Dublin, in which Ryle gave his results and Minkowski and I got very hot under the collar. I mean, 2C produced a slope of minus 3, you realize.
Yes, right. But why did Minkowski get upset?
Well, I think Minkowski was very well aware of confusion. I mean, Minkowski worked with all the data that came out, tried to identify, and, you know, he and I had talked on the sort of philosophy for the 90-foot dishes that you've really got to pull the source out with the primary beam before you can disentangle it with the interferometer. I mean, he...
Right, but hold on, now, this is summer of 55 before...
Yeah.
Before you're going to Caltech.
Yes.
So...
No, I was at Caltech then.
So you already had been there for a few months before?
Yes, I went there in January of
55. I'm sorry.
Beginning of 55. And,
so you had been discussing these issues...
Oh, yes.
But it's interesting, though, because I see him as one who's very interested in radio astronomy, but not as one who might appreciate the various subtleties, such as confusion and, you know, exactly how it works.
Yes, well, I mean, Minkowski was trying to identify things from the Mills survey, from the 3C survey, and so on, and I was arguing all the time, well, you know, the inherent accuracy is just not there. What we're building this for.
Right. And he wasn't finding anything.
He wasn't finding anything,
yeah.
You see.
Yeah.
And I knew he wasn't finding anything because there was nothing to find.
Okay. that Jodrell Bank meeting was also the one where the Russians claimed the deuterium on it.
Yeah, well, that stimulated me to get Stanley and Price to publish their results.
To write that up, yeah. Let's see, doing this chronologically now in terms of publications, the next thing I find is Bolton and Wild, I believe, where Paul Wild just told me about this last week, where he just had me passing through, but nevertheless, I'd like to hear your side of the story. How did this idea come about for the Zeeman splitting?
Well, Paul, I think, was spending some time at Harvard, and I'd invited him to come to Caltech to spend something like 6 weeks he spent with us there. And, he was coming up to Palomar to do some observations and help get the 30-foot running. Paul was there when we got the 30-foot running at Palomar, and also when we opened the Owens Valley site. I don't know how he spent 6 weeks or 3 months at least at the time. But Paul had... he'd visited Mount Wilson the day before,
mm-hmm.
and seen Horace's solar magnetograph. Horace Babcock's solar magnetograph. And we went... the idea came to us when we were driving up to Palomar, and we began discussing, I think, the question as to whether one could see the hydrogen 21 centimeter line in our own atmosphere in absorption against the sun.
I see.
And we began to think of all the things which would blur it out. And the Zeeman effect was one of them.
Oh, I see.
And Paul is sort of a little more theoretical than I am, and, you know, has numbers in his head. And we worked out that, you know, one Gauss, the Zeeman effect was
2.8 megahertz per Gauss. I think
per Gauss, yeah. Would wipe out any mm-hmm. possibility of seeing hydrogen in the space between us and the sun, and. I forget which one of us said, well, you know, what about the galaxy? And, of course, Paul had seen Horace's system.
Of switching...
And the two things together made the detection of intergalactic absorption and...
Interstellar, you mean?
Interstellar absorption possible, and I think at that time... Ed McLean had got the first 21 center with a narrow enough profile.
Yes, that had been around for a year or two by that time. And with quite a narrow profile.
That's right. And so we decided it could be done.
And,
we wrote
and of course, Paul had written that theoretical paper on the hydrogen spectrum. But also, I was interested to learn earlier today that you had an interest in the hydrogen line, even though you never published anything on it. fact, this may be your only publication on the hydrogen line, I'm not sure. I was always wondering how that sort of came out of the blue there. But it seems like mainly during these 4 years, there wasn't time to be trying to do any research. You were sort of totally preoccupied with...
Oh, we did quite a bit.
Getting the observatory going?
We had a low-frequency array at Owens Valley.
Oh, you did?
Barry Clark and I think, published the first occultation of the Crab Nebula by the Sun.
Stanley and Clark? Bolton Stanley and Clark?
That's right.
58 PASP. Lunar occultation of Taurus A at 12 meters, I see.
Yes. Solar occultation.
Ah, I had lunar written here, but you're right. No, that was not the first.
It was not the first, but it was the first really good one.
Okay.
I think Vitkevich had done some.
Right, in Cambridge they'd also done a couple.
Yes, but this was the first one at such very low frequencies.
At Westerbork, I mean at Dwingalo, even before the antenna could be fully moved, they put one together.
So but I mean, ours showed something like a 2 week occultation. We saw the corona out to
because you were at such a low frequency,
about 15 million miles.
I see. And what was this antenna? What did it consist of?
Dipole arrays on the ground.
Did you do anything else with that?
We did a lot. What was the question?
Did you do anything else with that dipole array besides the occultation work?
Yes, we studied. Tried to determine how much of apparent scintillation in an interferometer was phase and how much amplitude.
From the ionosphere?
Yes.
And you were telling me that that, in fact, never got published because you...
No, we were interested in that because I had consulted on low-frequency, low-angle effects with the people who are interested in direction of space vehicles which were to come. This was before the days of inertial guidance. And also we wanted to devise fringe tracking equipment for our later 90-foot interferometers.
So this was good training for someone like Barry Clark?
Yes. Yes, Barry was with me for a very long time because, of course, he started work in his first year as an undergraduate.
Oh, really?
Yes.
I didn't realize that. And so he was a freshman when you arrived?
That's right.
You both came to Caltech at the same
time?
Yes,
well, he got a summer job with me doing survey work and digging post holes.
Now, what about the 30-foot dish, which you've already said its primary purpose was as a model for the larger dishes, but it did do some hydrogen line work. It seems to me that it was sort of just filling in. I mean, it was just minor projects. Would you agree
with that? Yes, the 30-foot, we did a survey. I forget what declination range it covered, but we did survey, actually, sort of as far as we could get into the southern hemisphere.
So I think you went to 294.
Yeah, we extended the Dutch H-line survey down to there.
But you didn't do any analysis of this, really?
No, I mean...
your heart wasn't in it, is what I mean. You're just really
yes,
killing time in a
sense. Well, you've got to do some observing to find out how good or how bad the hardware is. And, of course, as soon as things started to move on the construction of the 90-foots, the whole effort transferred to the Owens Valley.
Well, okay, let's talk about the first experiments that were done with the 90-foots. I think even before the interferometer was ready, there was some single-dish work done. Is that right?
Yes. One of the very first observations was the one I referred to on Jupiter. And we first of all started off to, make a finding list of sources for work with the interferometer, find out what their fluxes were. We originally started off on, we had the idea of 400 megahertz when we started.
Right.
Now, what changed our minds, I think, was the ability to make good switches at much higher frequencies when the RF diodes came in.
Mm-hmm.
And we had mechanical switches at 400, and but these are very lossy as we went to higher frequencies. So the first observations, I think, were done at 700 megahertz. and within just a few months we transferred to 960. The reason for 960 was it was a frequency reserved for satellite communication.
I see. That didn't lead to any problems later on when there were
no
any satellites?
In fact, the first receivers of 960, which the Vanguard and the Vanguard stations used, were directly copied from our Caltech design.
And you say the Jupiter thing was one of the first.
Yes.
When you found out at NRL that they had detected a very high brightness. And I have here Wilson and Bolton. Oh, I'm sorry, that's another paper. So you weren't on that paper because you were away, is that?
Stanley and, it was Robertson Stanley, I think, or Stanley
right.
and Roberts, who
right.
did that Jupiter. Well, I was there, but they did it.
I've talked to Jim Roberts about that.
Yes, well, I think, in general, one of the staff members at Caltech took one of the students and... although we all worked together to a tremendous extent, for example, the work which Moffat and Morris did on angular sizes of sources, for example, each time we moved the 90-footer to a longer baseline, we had additional problems, and Bob Wilson and Radhik Krishnan and Jim Roberts and
Ken Kelly.
Alan Moffat, no, Ken was a bit later, Alan Moffat and I would go up and we'd make the thing... solve all the problems for making it work on the next baseline, and we'd do some Jupiter work, and then we'd leave it to Moffat and Morris to continue with a couple of weeks' observation, and then the...
So it was a real group effort.
The brain trust would come up later, and in general, one staff member was associated with one student... I mean, there were all student projects, really, so Roberts and Harris, who produced the CTA catalog, which was mainly force finding the 3C sources, Bob Wilson and I did the galactic plane survey, later on Radhik Krishnan and Barry Clark did the hydrogen line absorption work and so on. So it was generally one student, one staff member.
Well, besides from the Jupiter, what do you look upon as the main results that came out of the early years at Owens Valley?
Well, I think everybody did, all the projects did something useful. Moffat's thesis, what Morris and Moffat did, essentially said, gave us the statistics of the radio source population in terms of its angular diameter. I mean, they proved that the it was no fluke that Centaurus was a double and Cygnus was a double. Mm-hmm. Many, many sources had multiple structure. That was one thing that came out of it. The Jupiter work demonstrating, in fact, that Jupiter had a sort of super Van Allen belt system. The work by Radhik Krishnan and Clark on the two temperature interstellar medium, I think this was a rather fundamental thing.
Right.
And... last but not least, the improvement in radio source positions and the identifications which we got.
Okay, so the CTA survey was to check 3C positions.
Well, we had to have a finding list for sources.
Right.
And so Dan Harris and Jim Roberts started out to find out where the 3C sources were so that we could point the primary beam of one dish at them and then work at it with the interferometer. Actually, of course, Ken Kellerman has always claimed that I set astronomy back 10 years by following up 3C sources. That what we should have done was an independent survey. Then we discovered all the high frequency phenomena, which later, of course, we exploited very much at Parkes.
Mm-hmm. but what you found is that these sources were reliable, but often shifted by a lobe or two, I gather.
It would often take a whole night to find a 3C source because your alternate lobe positions were not necessarily correct. Most likely thing is for a lobe shift.
Right.
That is, if the source is completely isolated within the 3C antenna system, but it's not isolated, so fractional lobe shifts all the fractional lotus come in. So, in fact, one really had to survey something like five degrees square.
I see.
Well, say 5 degrees by 2 degrees to find a 3C source. And this is where the odd sources like CTA 26 and so on, with the peculiar inverted spectra, as they're now known, came from. I mean, there were the other things that were found along the way.
I see.
So the CTA survey is mostly 3C sources, but also picks up quite a few high frequencies.
CTA 102 also?
CTA 102, yes.
So you concluded, what did you then conclude about the reliability of the 3C survey?
Well, we just saved ourselves a lot of time by doing a survey of the sky.
is this work, you think, what convinced the Cambridge people that they needed to have a 3CR? Or how did that come about?
I don't know how the 3CR came about, but they only had to look at the CTA catalogue to find out how bad they were.
There was no one else checking these positions. No one else could, really, I guess.
No.
Yeah.
Of course, when the objects were isolated, the Cambridge positions were very, very good, at least in right ascension. And we did lean on the Cambridge results in, I suppose, the two prize identifications that came out of Caltech in the days when I was there, 3C295, which Minkowski got the redshift record, which has stood for... Until a couple of years ago, and 3C48. Now, we really depended on the cooperation of two observatories for that. As I said earlier, even before I went to Caltech, I had the... intuitively, I felt that one could describe, if you had a source which was so many minutes of arc in diameter, it was a galactic source of that size, or an extragalactic source much smaller. Now, one of the things we wanted were fundamental calibration points in the sky for the interferometer.
Right.
And high declination sources where we could measure declinations fairly accurately. Right ascensions, of course, depended on collimation. The reason you can measure declinations very accurately is because if you observe a source near zero, your error in your baseline parameters is so small on the period method. But we were looking, you see, a radio galaxy, for example, the work we'd done on structure, it was quite clear from Moffat's work that the optical center and the radio center didn't necessarily coincide. But quite obviously, the further you put something away, the less error you make in the assumption that the radio center is the optical center.
Yes, right.
And so we took... for a sort of major effort, the four sources which the Manchester people had been unable to resolve out with their longest baseline interferometry. Right. One of them was 3C295 and the other was 3C48.
Right, I think they had less than 10 arc seconds sort of sizes.
That's right. Right. Now, in the case of 3C295, our right ascension and the Cambridge right ascension were almost identical. And this said to us that neither of these systems, which have totally different primary beams, is affected by confusion.
Mm-hmm.
And this was enough to talk Minkowski into going after the spectrum of 3C295. Now, once we had 3C295, we had a fundamental calibrator for our right ascensions. And the next source we attempted... well, we attempted detailed analysis of many, many observations and the mean and everything like that. It was 3C48. And of course, 3C48 came out of the 16th magnitude star. And if it wasn't that 16th magnitude star on the Schmidt plate, the image of that 16th magnitude star was indeed covering up
something.
And what sort
of
radius?
What sort of error box did you have for your position with 3C48?
About 5 seconds, which you see is the size, is less than the image size.
Which is highly unusual to find a 16th magnitude star.
Yes.
Inside that, yeah.
Now, 295, I think we had something like 5 seconds in right ascension, that's combining our position with the Cambridge position, and something like 15 seconds of arc in declination. And this, in fact, included two galaxies. And Minkowski got spectra of them both.
of